I said, I should warn you, my cat has appeared right now. She's lying next to the computer. I'm hoping she won't get too disruptive, but she
I'm
does
surprised
love
mine hasn't decided to jump up.
she loves to crash Zoom meetings. She's a fixture of these meetings at work.
I call mine my assistant when she makes her appearances.
Drew's cat particularly loves to like nuzzle his microphone.
Yes.
My cat loves to rub her face on the screen, on the edge of the screen. What are you doing?
Hot pot of the South, not your daddy's Appalachia. Hot pot of the South, progress cannot wait.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pot of the South, a production of Change Tennessee. Pull up a chair and refill your sweet tea as we peel back the layers of Southern politics to get a better understanding of what's going on and why it matters. My name is Gabe. We are without Maggie, who managed to get lost in the minds of Polymer and Mills. In her stead, though, we are rejoined by Tennessee's galactic communist revolutionary, Drew Dyson.
Happy to be back, everyone.
Today, we have, without a doubt, our most decorated guest, Sari Robin. He is a senior advisor for the Americans United Against Church and State, editor of Church and State magazine, and author of 4 books and countless articles discussing the rise of the evangelical right. Welcome to the show, Rob Boston.
Thanks for having me on, gentlemen.
So, wow, that's a lot. Where do you have time for all of that?
Well, we are constantly challenged here at Americans United. There's a lot going on right now with separation of church and state, the very definition of religious freedom and what that means. We're challenged by some changes in the courts. We're challenged by the attitude of the U.S. Congress and many of the state legislatures. But we've been at this game for a long time. Americans United was founded in 1947. So we're talking about an organization that's coming up on 75 years, and we've been through rough times before, so we just keep on going.
When you guys have been at it for that long, you start kind of figuring out ways to chisel out every productive minute you can.
Yes, that's right. And we've got a great setup in our office where we have lawyers who handle our legal end of things. We have lobbyists who go down to Capitol Hill and work with legislators there. We have an outreach department that gets people organized in the states and local communities. And we, of course, have communications, which is what I work in, trying to get our message out through the media. And we have fundraisers and other folks work behind the scenes to keep the organization going. So it's a well-oiled machine, one that sometimes gets a little overheated because of all the work it's doing. Right. Nevertheless, we keep at it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that background. I'm sure a lot of people aren't necessarily familiar with Americans United, and I wasn't for a while. So that's kind of a cool little background for anybody who's new to hearing about y'all's organization. So as we've kind of alluded to, we are going to be discussing kind of religious liberty and religious freedom today. But before we get into that discussion and why it's so important to actually have real religious liberty and why we shouldn't codify religious ideology, what's something that you feel just needs a really good spotlight right now?
I would say that we really need a spotlight on history, because there's an effort underway to teach what I would call a really whitewashed version of history. And this applies down the line, not just affecting issues of separation of church and state, but a lot of different things. You know, we've been hearing a lot of talk lately about critical race theory, and that's become kind of the new Fox News right-wing bogeyman. You know, ooh, critical race theory is coming to get your kids and all this kind of stuff. But really, all we're really talking about it with issues like that is an accurate accounting of our history. That the purpose of studying history and reading history and learning history is not to conclude that your nation has never done anything wrong and that it's great and that it's always right. The purpose of studying and learning history is to find out what happened. And if when we face our history, honestly, we do see examples of people being treated differently because of the color of their skin or their gender or their sexual orientation, or the fact that they were among the native population. And it does no good for us to try to cover that up or pretend that that didn't happen or to act like it wasn't so bad. And it is especially offensive, I think, when white men are the ones leading this charge for this really watered down, rah, rah, USA, USA kind of history that we're seeing being promoted right now. Yeah, around the country and in a number of states, where some states have even passed laws saying that critical race theory can't be discussed or for teaching, you know, really watered down approaches to the Civil War and other important points in history. So I would say a spotlight on history is absolutely essential just to understanding who we are as Americans and how we're going to move forward.
I think it's very timely that you bring that up anyways, Rob, because I know one of the last episodes I was on, we talked about where we stand in the midterms coming up. And we talked about how basically the right's plan is to use these culture war ideological differences, like critical race theory, in which they are just defining it however they want to define it to fit their narrative rather than actually understanding what it is. And especially here in Tennessee, we're seeing those same white men try and attack and dismantle and start fights over, you know, something that they really don't care about, but that they know is a way to rile up their base. And they know it's a way to create division. And like you said, I mean, to create that rah-rah narrative around USA and to pretend that it's only been good things and we can only look at the good things.
Yeah, and you know, that is an old game for the right wing in this country, always looking for some culture war issue to promote because they have no actual ideas. I'm friends with a gentleman named Steve Bannon, who is Rachel Maddow's blogger. And Steve last year wrote a book called The Imposters that I really recommend to folks out there. It is essentially a discussion of how modern GOP politics is not based on policy anymore. It's just one outrageous idea after another that they promote through right-wing media to get people all worked up into a frenzy. And, you know, it used to be the LGBTQ community. They would target them for attacks, and they're still doing that, especially the transgender community. I'm seeing a lot of that right now. But more and more, it's this critical race theory. It's racially based appeals. Not even subtle. That is the basis of their driving people to the polls. So it's not actually, well, here's our idea for dealing with the economy, or here's our idea for dealing with healthcare. They don't have any ideas. They just have this constant sense of outrage that they use to promote getting people out and to vote for them.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, you know, not to continue to stick on this topic when we've got a very big one to talk about that very much relates to this, but, you know, you saw that in 2015 and 2016 and then candidate Donald Trump's, you know, campaign rallies. There was these ideas to build a border wall, but there was never actually a plan for it. It was a culture war towards immigration and a lot of the other issues that he tried to rally this extreme group of right-wing voters to elect him. And he ultimately was successful in that. And, you know, we're going to be having this conversation about religious freedom. And I think that's, you know, a timeless one that always is something that they can fall back on, even when the tides of whatever we're at within our culture is, you know, you mentioned it was LGBTQ. And yes, we still have a lot of focus on transgender rights and attacks on that community. But what we're not seeing is as much as back in 2015, when gay marriage became legal, that it's not as much in the news anymore. It's not as much as one of their talking points, but you don't see them going out and just campaigning, like you said, on economic issues or healthcare issues. It's how can we pit one side against the other?
Yes. And actually the church state issues that I deal with every day are often fodder for that. I mean, think about things like prayer in schools and what the role of religion ought to be in public schools, the teaching of creationism, the display of religious symbols in public spaces, all these sorts of issues that are really get people worked up and hit them in the gut. Those have been exploited for decades now as part of the culture.
Absolutely. I just think we should probably start making like Howard Zinn required reading for kids or for students. I mean, I think that'll really help, especially his people's history, where it's like, why don't we tell the story that doesn't normally get told? And exactly like you're saying, Rob, you start seeing the real history of our country. And
you know, it's funny that you mentioned Zinn. I've heard progressives say, oh, it's such a negative book. And I'm thinking, yes, he's telling the story of marginalized communities. He's putting the story of the Native people front and center. He's putting the story of African-Americans front and center, of women, of socialists, and people who were always on the fringes. And they were attacked for their very existence. So yes, obviously, it's going to be somewhat of a negative story. Again, the purpose of the history is not to make you feel good. It's to tell you what happened. And I think hopefully as a nation resolved that we all will do better going forward.
We could literally probably just have an entire discussion on this, but another topic for another day. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to jump right into religious freedom and religious liberty. Stay tuned. Our sponsor this week is near and dear to all Tennesseans, which is the Southern Baptist Convention, who operate an office in Nashville. Whether they are preaching to strip away rights from the LGBTQ plus community or women, you can always count on them for the most literal interpretation of the Bible. Southern Baptist Convention. If it's in the Bible, then it should be in the law. For tuning in, and we're going to jump right into discussing religious freedom and religious liberty. And to kind of start this conversation, we want to take a look at what does it mean on paper? I mean, part of the First Amendment, right to organize, you know, the state will establish no religion. But from what we've seen and kind of what we've experienced, especially here lately, those don't really seem to line up with the reality of the situation. Kind of, Rob, why don't you start us kind of being there on the front lines and, you know, being having your hand in the fight constantly. What have you been seeing with that?
Well, the first thing we need to remember is that the religion clauses of the First Amendment are only 16 words long. There's a real economy of words there, and that's commendable on the part of the founders in some ways, but it also leaves for some ambiguity. To say Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Did they really mean there can be no law restricting religious freedom? Well, no, of course not. There are some practices that are dangerous, that subject people to harm, that take away people's rights. So obviously there have to be some restrictions there. And also too, we have to go back and kind of look at what the situation was on the ground at the time those words were written. There were parts of our nation where people were having difficulty engaging in the religious freedom of their choice, engaging in the religious activity of their choice. Remember, the First Amendment only applied to the federal government, and some of the states still had official churches, and they would persecute people who were outside that church or had beliefs that the ruling class didn't like. So the real challenge for people back in the day was, when it came to religious freedom, was just accessing it at its most basic level. The right to walk into a Baptist church in Virginia, which had an Anglican establishment. The right to worship openly as a Quaker, which was challenged in some of these early situations. The right to be a Roman Catholic, which in a majority Protestant nation was not always secure. The right to be Jewish. The right to not have a belief. The sort of things that we take for granted today were not secure 250 years ago. So when we first start having this discussion about religious freedom, that's the place we have to begin, to understand that people didn't have the most basic rights. The First Amendment was designed to ensure that at least the federal government would not infringe on those rights.
Interesting, because a lot of your original founding fathers and kind of that generation were trying to find, you know, their religious freedom from by separating from the Church of England. You know, they were the enlightened ones, so to speak. So they kind of have a tendency to write in these vague, pretentious, you know, if you will, these pretentious words and phrases. But like you were saying, it's what they were writing and maybe what the intention is and what the society of the time is very different.
That's an important point. I think we have to remember that this idea of severing religion and government to the extent that the founders did was unprecedented. Nobody had tried that for the longest time, especially in the European experience. The common understanding was that church and state could not exist without a mutual dependency. And now we saw the problems that created, especially during the Middle Ages, where there was so much religious conflict and so much war because of differences of religious opinion. And it's important to remember that key founders like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and George Washington and some of the others were keen students of history. You will read a lot of historical references and allusions in their writings. And what they understood was that this combination of church and state had suppressed human freedom for so long and resulted in war and death and violence. So the idea was to just cut that tie, make that separation. As I said, a radical experiment. And certainly there were people back in the day who opposed that, but they ended up on the losing side. And I think when I look back now at the results of the experiment, you can only feel that it was very successful because we have so much diversity in the country, both religious and non-religious diversity. And I think that too was the intent of the framers all along. One of the beliefs that you see when you read their writings was that if you had a lot of religions and a lot of different philosophies in the country, they kind of kept a check on one another. No one group got so large or powerful that it could suppress others. And the idea of what Madison called a multiplicity of sects, you know, all these different denominations, you wanted that. It kept anyone from getting too powerful and controlling the government and suppressing people.
And, you know, the First Amendment and that clause in particular has been fantastic for many different faiths in this country. But, you know, I'm thinking now, you know, 250 years later, we're looking and seeing that there, you know, gosh, as long as I've been alive, there has always been this constant war on Christianity that has been narrated by the right. And it seems like every time we have that, you know, one, as progressives, we're forced to make a counter argument to that, or we're forced to have some kind of backup to, you know, America is not a Christian nation. And so now we're seeing that kind of get distorted. And we, you know, have seen this rise in religious freedom bills pop up in state legislatures. In 93, the U.S. Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which basically said the same thing as the First Amendment, just applied it more to federal government and departments so they couldn't unnecessarily burden religious individuals, which was perfectly fine. But I want to get kind of your ideas of how we went from, you know, this great idea, you know, 250 years ago to actively work to separate church and state, to now where we have one party that is actively pushing and campaigning practically on a church-state model.
Right. Well, there's always been a faction among us who does not support the idea of separation of church and state. They were present during the founding period. They've been with us all through history. And they, at different points in our history, their power has peaked and waned. We're at a period right now where they're fairly strong. And it's remarkable to me to think that there are people out there who oppose the idea of separation of church and state. To me, that's like opposing free speech, you know, or the right to go out and march and petition the government or other freedoms found in the First Amendment. But there are folks out there because they're convinced that their particular religious expression, whatever it may be, is right and true and others are wrong. And therefore, it's just logical that the government would align with the true faith that these folks just happen to have stumbled upon, and would use that to form the basis of the law, and that everybody should have to follow that, because otherwise, you know, you're living in sin. So these are folks who would use government as a type of theological enforcer. Now, we know that doesn't work. We know it from European history, and we know it from our own history from the period before we adopted the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. We saw the problems that caused, but for whatever reason, these folks stubbornly refuse to acknowledge the lesson of history and continue to believe, and I don't want to shock anybody here, but I really believe this is true. They continue to embrace the idea of a theocracy as opposed to a democracy.
Absolutely.
And we have to fight them every day, because what they're really trying to do is take this country's secular government and turn it into a vehicle for the promotion of a very fundamentalist, strict, conservative form of Christianity.
And to that point, too, you know, you've talked about how these groups have always been with us throughout history. I'm just curious, I know you've got this background. Has there ever been a force almost as strong as the evangelical movement has been, especially in this aspect in the modern political history?
I would say the closest we ever came was in the post-Civil War era, which was, of course, an extremely chaotic time for this country's history. Whenever people are thrown into a situation of chaos and great social upheaval, some of them naturally gravitate to systems that provide quick or an easy answer, such as fundamentalism. So in the late 19th century, there was this movement among Protestant ministers. They formed a group called the National Reform Association, and they wanted to add a Christian Nation Amendment to the Constitution. They wanted to rewrite the preamble to the Constitution to explicitly state that the United States was officially a Christian nation, that it recognized the authority of Jesus Christ, and get several references to God in there. Because remember, the Constitution as originally written contains no references to God, Jesus Christ, or Christianity. I mean, it's amazing. A document written at that time does not contain those things, because that was pro forma, that language usually, but it's not in there. We have a holy secular Constitution. So these ministers started pushing for this. And they actually got it introduced in Congress, and there was a vote on it in the late 1880s. Now, obviously, we know this thing didn't pass. It's not part of our Constitution now. But they had enough power to push that. And at the same time, some of the things that they, other agenda items that they had, did get put into law. For example, religiously based censorship. You know, back then, you were talking about stage plays being a popular medium, magazines and books. They were able to get things censored if they offended majority Christian sentiment. And we didn't really start to chip away at that until the 1950s and 60s. So they had a long run there. Sunday closing laws. You may be familiar with the Sunday closing laws. You know, why some stores aren't open on Sunday, why they're restricted hours. That grew out of that same period too. These people believed Sunday was the Lord's day and that you shouldn't be working. You shouldn't do commerce. So they got laws passed in a lot of states for Sunday closing. they began to take control of the public school system as it started to evolve. Public education in the United States is largely a post-Civil War phenomenon. That's when it really started to take off. That's when states began to institute it, pass laws requiring students be educated. Well, these extreme conservative Protestants got in there and they got their religious prayers in the schools. And again, it took to the 1960s to get those out of there. So they had a pretty good run. And I think that's about as closest we've ever come to really embracing a theocratic mindset. And it lasted longer than probably a lot of people realize.
I mean, I had no idea about a lot of those things. And it seems like, you know, if we were teaching that, maybe we would have a better understanding of how to avoid it in the future. But like you said, there's some people that want that. Rob, I have another question kind of before we meld into this, like, where has this gotten us now? How has the courts reacted to religious liberty kind of throughout the more modern era? I don't want to burden you with throughout the entire nation's history, but you know, we had the more liberal Warren Court into the more conservative Rehnquist Court and into the modern day court. I'm just curious how those courts reacted to these cases of religious liberty.
Right. Well, we're in a very difficult situation right now because the Supreme Court has become so conservative with three justices put on the court by Trump. That the Trump years, it pains me to say this, but they were a good bit more substantial than a lot of people think. You know, even though he only had one term, his impact on the courts was profound. And we're seeing the court really moving away from the traditional embrace of separation of church and state. I mean, it was a time in the 1970s, we had a court that was very strongly pro-separation of church and state. And they didn't allow taxpayer money to go to private religious education. Well, you know, that was reversed in the 2000s. They upheld the idea of religious freedom as an important individual right, but not something that gave you the ability to take away the rights of others or cause them harms. We're seeing that standard being eroded. It's very disheartening. We have to kind of remember that for better or for worse, under our system, the Supreme Court has a lot of power in determining these issues, less so than Congress and state governments. They're the final word. And right now we're just in a situation where we've got a very conservative court that is really eroding the idea of establishment of religion. First Amendment has those two concepts, no establishment of religion and protection of free exercise. They're eroding the no establishment part and they're lifting free exercise up to really this extreme interpretation that is allowing people to do things that cause others harm. And that's simply not what religious freedom is intended to do.
I think, you know, while we're talking about the courts, I mean, especially here in Tennessee, you know, we get the famous, I believe it was like the Scripps court case about teaching evolution in school, where you're talking about, you know, we rewind a little bit and you do have a Supreme Court that is against separation of church and state, because at the time, creationism was the de facto way to teach science, especially in the South. And it took the state, it getting appealed past the state of Tennessee Supreme Court to actually move into a secular education of sciences, especially as it pertains to evolution.
Yeah, that's an important issue. You know, the Scopes trial in 1925, that was pivotal. And yeah, there was, you know, a lot of people look at that history and they say, well, the fallout from that was, even though Scopes was found guilty, although later that was overturned on the technicality, the negative publicity that Tennessee suffered from that and the fundamentalists suffered from that led people to kind of pull back a little bit. And to some extent, that's true. But there were still anti-evolution laws in some states. Arkansas had one, for example. It was illegal to teach evolution. And that was challenged at the Supreme Court in the late 1960s. And in 1987, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Louisiana's so-called balanced treatment law that required creationism to be taught alongside evolution. Now, if that case were to get up before the Supreme Court today, honestly, I don't know how that might turn out. It might be different. And in some states, state legislators are aware that the court is shifting and they're starting to look at ways to pass laws so they can get new challenges up before the court. And that's very disturbing because this court has shown a tendency to overturn precedent. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but there's a legal principle called stare decisis. And stare decisis basically means respect precedent. You don't just overturn decades of precedent. Well, this court, unfortunately, shown a tendency to do that, to overturn the precedent. So no one should think that these cases that have been decided are in cement, you know, that they're anchored in cement. They're not. They can be pulled right out and overturned.
First of all, thank you for not ripping on me for saying Scripps instead of Scopes. Scripps here in Knoxville, Scripps is like one of the largest employers. So that name is like ingrained into every Knoxvillian's head. But secondly, I think you talking about how there's not really much regard for precedent when it comes to court cases. I mean, I think that really shows kind of the impact and the future of like religious freedom and how we can kind of expect things to go as it pertains to the scopes, as we're discussing, you know, talking about creationism versus evolution. But to what you guys were talking about earlier, you know, there's a lot of attacks and a lot of it's this religiosity and the moral majority ideology is really being used to target the LGBTQ plus and trans communities through laws and appeals and that kind of thing. And so we're really starting to see, you know, these religious beliefs start to get codified through the guise of religious freedom or religious liberty. The first thing that comes to mind with everybody is the Colorado bakery. But you see things like that, especially here in the South, where they won't necessarily be explicit with it, but they'll make you feel real uncomfortable, like right from the start.
Yeah, one thing I've learned about religious right groups over the years, and I've been at Americans United since 1987, so it's been a while. One thing I've learned about them is that they just keep at it. When they lose something, like when they lost marriage equality at the Supreme Court in 2015, they just didn't shrug and say, oh, we lost. I guess we'll go home now. No, they immediately started thinking, well, how can we erode that? How can we chip away at that? What's the next thing coming down the pipe that we can use? And what they decided to do was to start arguing that secular businesses, again, when we're talking about secular businesses, we're not talking about houses of worship. Secular business owners should have the right to refuse service to members of the LGBTQ community because of their religious beliefs. And arguing that this was the legitimate expression of faith. Now, again, I want to be clear about this. We're not talking about a minister at a church. Everybody knows that a minister or a rabbi or a priest or an imam or whatever you might be has the right to decide what types of people they will give the services to. So if a church doesn't want same-sex couples to come to its services, they don't have to let them in. Churches have an absolute right on these matters. But we're not talking about churches here. We're talking about florists. We're talking about bakers. We're talking about people who own hotels and B&Bs. We're talking about wedding photographers. We're talking about caterers. We're talking about a lot of different people engaged in secular businesses who are saying, I don't want to serve LGBTQ people. Now think back when we heard those types of arguments before. It was during the Jim Crow era in the South where you had business owners saying, we're not going to let Black people stay at this hotel. We're not going to let them eat in our restaurant, but they can't come in here. Oh, you know, maybe they can come into the movie theater, but there's a balcony, they have to go up there. This segregation or denial of services. Now, we thought we had stamped that out with the passage of the Civil Rights Law. Here we are seeing it raise its head again in the modern era. And this time it's being dressed up in what I think is the great principle of religious freedom. They're misusing that noble principle of religious freedom for shabby forms of discrimination. It's appalling. But this is where we are. Now, the Supreme Court has not yet fully embraced that idea. There are three justices on the court who clearly are ready to say that. You should have a religious-based right to discriminate against folks. And then there's a faction of three who are the progressives who are totally against it. And then there's three in the middle who knows how far they'll go. So we really have this divided court. But clearly, it's disturbing because 10 or 15 years ago, these types of cases being brought by religious right legal organizations representing bakers and caterers and other folks, they would have been laughed out of court. They would have never gone this far. Yet now they're getting serious hearings before the highest court in the land. It's disturbing.
Yeah. And I remember right after Obergefell v. Hodges was decided and you know, same-sex marriage became law of the land, there was huge outcries from all across the country. And I think what caught the GOP's eye to Pence was his state was one of the first to pass a religious freedom law. In response to that, I know in Tennessee, shortly after that decision came down, they attempted to pass a bill that would say that they don't recognize the Supreme Court's decision. They recognize God's law. And then there was the famous, and I'm going to get the location wrong, but I feel like it was here in Athens, Tennessee, where a hardware store posted signs that said no gays allowed. And, you know, it's 6 years removed now from where we are, and it's not as explicit, but we're seeing that same battle still face out with, you know, transgender rights, right? Like you said, as well as these privately owned businesses being able to decide who they can and don't want to serve. But, you know, I think one of the ones that we've always seen it in, ever since it was decided in 1973 is the abortion case. I mean, that to me is the biggest one that the religious right try to impose their beliefs on and use every mode and method, and quite frankly are the closest probably at implementing in some form or fashion.
Yes, actually, that's been a long-running battle, and they may be on the verge of winning it, unfortunately. You probably know the U.S. Supreme Court has accepted a case from Mississippi dealing with abortion. They passed a very restrictive law in that state. Lower courts struck it down, but now the Supreme Court's going to give it a hearing during its next term, which begins in October. So at this time next year, we could be looking at a situation where legal abortion is gone in half the country, if not more. The Supreme Court may toss this issue back. If they overturn Roe v. Wade, they'll toss the issue back to the states. And of course, we know there are a number of states that will ban it immediately. So that's an area where they're getting definite progress. And it's another area that's a little bit under the radar that folks need to be aware of, and that is the attack on birth control. I mentioned earlier some of these business owners that are saying they don't want to serve members of the LGBTQ community. We're also seeing the owners of secular businesses, again, secular companies, not houses of worship, not temples, not churches, not mosques, secular businesses saying that they do not want to provide or tolerate the presence of birth control in an employee health care plan, even if they're not required to pay for it. Now, the Affordable Care Act mandates that birth control be covered. And some of these owners are saying, well, it offends my religion. I'm not going to tolerate its presence. Now, think about that for a minute. Nobody's being compelled to use it. You're not even required to pay for it. You simply have to tolerate its existence in the plan so that your employees who want it can access it. And that's too much for these folks. And that is a legitimate expression of religious freedom. You know, excuse me, how can that possibly be considered religious freedom? What somebody else is doing with their own healthcare decisions does not stop you from going to church. It does not stop you from praying. It does not stop you from reading the Bible or the Quran or any other religious book. It doesn't stop you from doing anything about your religion. Yet we are at a situation now with religious freedom being so warped by the Supreme Court that these arguments actually get a serious hearing.
Like you said, for these instances, I mean, what it's really doing is it's propping up and codifying very specific sects of a religion. This is not all, you know, a lot of these like anti-abortion, anti-birth control, anti-LGBTQ+ laws are not indicative of all of Christianity or indicative all of Islam or Judaism or anything. It's these very loud minorities of it. But because they've kind of, like you've been saying, they've been fighting this fight on abortion, you know, for the past since 72, 73, and even before then, because of how long that case took to settle out, you know, they've been able to really get their microphone tuned in and have the amps blasting to make themselves louder than what their representation is.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's so frustrating right now for me is that the court, especially the Supreme Court, they seem disconnected from reality sometimes. For example, surveys show that 95% of Roman Catholics are using birth control. 95%. Basically, its use is universal. It is an important part of healthcare. It's an important part of women's healthcare. It's an important part of a couple's private decisions about how they're going to run their lives, what type of families they want to have, if any. And it seems sometimes that these decisions just don't acknowledge that reality. And I think that, you know, obviously the court needs to look at constitutional principles, but it also needs to look at the way people are living their lives in reality. We saw this play out again during the fights at the court over COVID and some of the restrictions that were put into place when the pandemic was raging at its height. Now, normally the government wouldn't have the power to shut down a private entity or to restrict how many people could come to a church or a play or any kind of an event like that. But they did have that power because of the extraordinary nature of this public health emergency. And houses of worship were treated just like similarly situated entities. You couldn't go to a large church service. You couldn't go to a large poetry recital. You couldn't go to a big stadium and hear a rock concert. You couldn't go hear a speech. You couldn't go to the movies. I mean, there were a lot of things where people gathered. The restrictions were put on equally across the board. And the Supreme Court started out very sensibly recognizing that reality and upholding those restrictions. But then Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. We got Justice Amy Coney Barrett, and the court flipped and started handing down these decisions that said that's a violation of religious freedom. Well, everybody's in the same boat in this case. Secular entities and religious entities were treated the same. And when that is the case, it's not a violation of religious freedom. And in an extraordinary case where we were trying to keep the lid on a dangerous pandemic, sometimes you have to take steps that are uncomfortable for people, but the court simply refused to recognize that. And I think in those misguided decisions probably extended the pandemic and our misery beyond what we needed to have there.
Absolutely, especially as it pertains to the pandemic, as you're talking, we discussed a parallel issue in our last episode about climate change. When you have massive issues that cross state borders, that cross national borders, everybody has to be willing to row the boat in the same direction. You have to be willing to do a couple things a little different in order to move forward, to beat whatever the issue is. And when religion gets tossed into that, or my freedom, whether it's my ability to drive a Hummer or to go sit in a room with 500 other people without a mask during a pandemic, people pump the brakes and say, no, 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 you can't do that. I have the right to do this. That's my religion. It's like, well, all these people in this room, you're going to be going to 10 of their funerals in a couple weeks. We have this fetishization of freedom and the American individualism, and it puts us at a huge disadvantage rather than trying to, like you're saying, see the bigger picture, see what's going on the society as a whole.
Right, exactly. One of the things that's very discouraging about modern life is that attitude. I've read the history books about what it was like in this country during the Second World War and how people pulled together and recognized that struggle, made sacrifices. I've talked to older folks who were alive at that time who speak about what that national spirit was like. And you have to wonder today if we could even conjure that in any way. Certainly during COVID, we failed spectacularly. And a lot of it was, quite frankly, because of conservatives, whether religious conservatives or secular conservatives, simply deciding that their individual right to do something meant more than their ability to protect their own neighbors. It's remarkable. And we're still seeing it now. Even as we enter this period where there are vaccinations available, we see it in the numbers of people resisting, the numbers of resisting among the white evangelical community are quite higher than the rest of the population. And you get this sense that they really have entered a situation of an alternative reality where they will listen to a Fox News Channel host more than a respected doctor or an epidemiologist. That's where we are, unfortunately. And before we had the vaccines, we were not in a situation where those bad decisions didn't affect us. They did. There's less of that now, but it's still a concern because there are some people who, for medical reasons, can't be vaccinated, or very young children can't be. And it just sort of saddens me that so much of this is being done in the name of religion. But I want to add that, of course, there are a lot of good folks out there in religious communities who have rebuked that spirit, who have led the way, who sponsored vaccination drives, who told their congregants to listen to Dr. Fauci and the other experts. It's just this faction of extreme conservative fundamentalists who seem determined to upset everything and create as much chaos as they can.
And Rob, I kind of have two questions for you on this. You know, you talked about how we've gotten so divisive that we probably can never work together the same way we did, you know, back in the day. Kind of likewise, bringing this back to this religious aspect, I have friends who have grown up Christian their entire life, who've gone to church all their life, and now that they've reached this stage in adulthood, they can't find a church that fits their needs because they feel that the church has been pulled in a rightward direction that's not compatible with how they view their faith. And so I guess my first part is the religious right actually doing more damage? And two, I guess I'm going to kind of answer my own question on this one. We're actually seeing the size of people who actually attend church dropping in this country. And is this minority hold going to outlast this for the long term? Or is this something that might eventually fade away?
That's a really interesting question. And there is some statistical data that indicates that the reason so many people have turned away from organized religion is that they were tired of the politicization of it, especially with the right-wing cast that was given to so much of it. They were tired of the attacks on the LGBTQ community, and they just drifted away. Now, you know, demographically, things can change as people get older. Maybe they'll come back or whatever, but for now, what you are finding is a lot of people are basically saying, well, it's not that they're atheists or agnostics or they've embraced non-belief. They just can't find a good spiritual home, as you note. So they're doing their own thing. That's become a very popular way of having a spirituality in this country, and having a spiritual life is a mixture of traditions or the creation of your own spirituality, whatever it may be. And, you know, actually, that's not a new idea. Thomas Jefferson was notoriously difficult to pin down on his religious beliefs. and once said to a friend, I am a sect unto myself as far as I know. A lot of people are taking that spirit and running with it, and it will have profound impacts on the questions of separation of church and state and the religious demographics of the country. As some of these congregations start to shrink, there are a couple of things we're going to need to deal with. For better or for worse, a lot of social services in this country are provided by religious communities. I think that's probably a mistake. I think we need to be shifting more to a Western European social welfare model where the state directly provides those services. But we've allowed that in this country. But if there are fewer and fewer of them to do that, we're going to need to be looking at other ways to get that job done. Also, we might see an unfortunate trend as some congregations start to dwindle. They may begin to look to the state for types of relief. The Catholic Church is already notorious for doing that. Its private school system has been losing enrollment for years. Instead of just accepting that reality, they demand government-sponsored bailouts in the form of school vouchers. So that's another thing we need to keep our eye on.
All right, fun little story about that. My former state representative who decided to retire after his state voucher bill failed here in Tennessee. I attended the same private Catholic school that his son did. And I know without a doubt that is exactly the reason that he wanted to pass this bill was because they were legacies of this private institution. I benefited from that private institution, but I understand that that is a choice made by individuals and families to decide where to send their children. And it's a much bigger conversation, but you make that choice to step outside the public school system, and it shouldn't fall on the state to pay for religiously funded institutions like that.
Right. There are lots of people who, for whatever reason, decide to duplicate a government service. You don't get a rebate when you do that. I buy a lot of books. That doesn't mean I can say I don't want to support the public library anymore. I'm buying my own books. Or somebody puts a pool in their backyard and says, well, I've got my own pool now. I'm not going to support the recreation center. Or I don't take the bus. Why should I? I own a car. Why should I pay for the bus? That isn't the way it works in this country. There are public services that are designed to benefit all of us. And we all benefit from having an educated population. So we all pay for that. But it astounds me that there are these people out there who actually make this argument. Well, why should I have to pay for the public schools? My kids go to St. Ignatius or whatever. Because an ignorant population is in nobody's benefit? How about that? That's a pretty good answer. But you get that mindset, and you have people basically arguing for these types of bailouts. And I think we may see more of that as the religious demographics of the country continue to shift.
Kind of touched on a lot here, especially with how the courts and everything have been taking up new cases, how we're really kind of seeing the, again, I've said it multiple times, like the codification of the religious right, taking elements of a very specific sect of the evangelicals are kind of being able to write laws and letting it go, you know, letting the courts sort it out, which, as you were saying earlier, Rob, that's in the aftermath of the Trump administration, that definitely leans in their favor. What can we do going forward? You know, with stuff going to the courts, what can, you know, the average citizen do? You know, we're talking about stuff at the legislature. You know, we can write our senators, write our representatives. So there's that. But a lot of the stuff is kind of slowly moving beyond that. So what can we do to try to curb that?
Yes, very good point. Well, I think one of the most important things that organizations like my own can do is be very strategic and thoughtful in the kind of cases that we're involved in the courts, and not bring cases that have the potential to create bad law. Now, sometimes that's beyond our control. There'll be other groups that bring cases, and we have to respond to those. But, you know, ultimately, this is going to be a battle that plays out largely on political fields. Now, Americans United is a nonpartisan organization. We're tax exempt, and we're not allowed to get involved in partisan politics. So we don't endorse or oppose candidates. But basically, we need to be working through the appropriate vehicles to advocate for a type of understanding of that there's a political dimension to all these issues, and to be involved in that. And also, too, I would say to understand the nature and the interconnectedness of issues like voter suppression, how important that is to these issues, and to be working to oppose that. Essentially, conservatives are trying to keep people away from the ballot box, certain types of people who aren't likely to vote for them. And they're doing that because they want to be able to force their policies into play. And we really need to be aware that voter suppression is an important issue that we all need to be fighting.
Yeah, so really, like you said, to not necessarily look at the politicians, the person behind the podium, but look at what their policy is and make sure that the policies that are going to be introduced any side of the aisle, up, down, left, right, benefits everybody. And when we mean everybody, we actually mean everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And right now we're in a situation where, due to voter suppression, gerrymandering, and, you know, other things like that, I fear we may be entering a period where the minority voice is the controlling one. And that's disturbing. I think that's out of step with what most Americans want. And there are ways to combat that, but they take time and effort, and people just have to be willing to put that muscle in there. And another thing too is there is still a moderate, it's a small voice, but there is still a moderate voice in the GOP. And to the extent that people are willing to stand up and challenge the some extremely conservative fundamentalist view of things, that is helpful. Now, there aren't a lot of those voices out there today, but there are some. And we need to be egging them on and giving them whatever kinds of support we can, because I just don't think it's in our nation's interest to have a system where one party has basically turned its back on democracy. That's not helpful. To be expected, the political parties would have differences of opinion on policy, that they would have different approaches. But when one party has basically embraced insurrection and fanaticism, that's not a recipe for a successful democracy.
Absolutely. Well, definitely some stuff to think on and some ways that we can get involved and make sure that the religious liberty actually remains in a way to where if you're Jewish, you can do what you want. If you're atheist, you can do what you want and all that. We're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we've got a few people that could really just use a good old bless your heart.
If you ask the leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention, they will tell you the only way forward is to merge schools and fundamentalist Christian teachings. Despite the First Amendment, they hold firm that the way to move our country forward is through rampant school prayer and public funding of religious schools. Southern Baptist Convention. To be a moral nation, America needs to be a Christian nation.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us so far. And we're going to move into close things out. But again, before we do that, we just have a handful of people that could really just use a good old bless your heart.
It's Bless Your Heart with Bobby June.
Hello, hello. Oh, my, you little angels. Look at you, just so wonderful. Thank you. And bless your heart.
Bless your heart.
Rob, who do you think needs a good bless your heart over these next couple of weeks?
Well, I'm going to say this is maybe a little strange because it's going to be pivoting away from what we've been talking about today, but people with the UFOs, look, you got it. You just got to get a grip. All right. There's UFO stuff. This happens every few years. There's all these sightings. People get all excited. In the 1950s, there were people running around saying that they've been contacted by space people that lived on Mars and Venus. And in the 19th century, there were these airships people were seeing in the sky. This is always happening. And you know what? It's always a nothing burger. So this latest round of this UFO stuff, it's going to turn out to be the same way. And, you know, think about this. If there were space aliens out there, and maybe there are, I don't know, do we really want them to come here? Because we're going to be the Incas and they're going to be the conquistadors. So folks, let up on the UFO stuff, please.
I am so glad you said that, especially the analogy, because it never goes well for the inhabitants. It only goes well for the explorers.
We like our natural resources and they'll take them all away. Look, I've read enough science fiction novels to know how this works out, okay? Trust me on this one, all right?
Well, Drew, what about you? Do you have someone in mind that needs a good old bless your heart?
I got a whole news station that could use a bless your heart. I'm going to go with Fox News. And I guess if I had to pick one person, we'll go with specifically Tucker Carlson. Now, what did he do this time? Well, you know, it was reported by the New York Times not too long ago that Fox News actually has a requirement that you must have a vaccine or a test in order to work at a facility there. So, you know, from 8 o'clock until 11 o'clock at night, we're getting all these insane conspiracy theories on why people shouldn't be getting the vaccine, about how they're dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. And these same people that are giving these talking points and segments are the same ones that have been vaccinated already. And they're perfectly fine. They're perfectly safe as this new fourth wave kind of comes through and hits unvaccinated individuals and communities. They're going to be safe. They have no intentions of feeling upset or hurt when they go to cash their paychecks in for the amount of people that they are going to do damage to because of their words and the segments that they have on. So my bless your heart today goes out to all of Fox News, Tucker Carlson, for just keeping this pandemic alive, unfortunately.
I did see this the other day, though. One of their correspondents said not getting the vaccine is like going cliff diving. But hey, as an American, you're free to go cliff diving. So I know there's some good places in Mexico to go do it.
It's been insane. And just the hypocrisy, of course, is nothing new. But this is something playing with individuals' lives, and they feel no remorse over it. All right, Gabe, what is your bless your heart?
I actually have a geopolitical leader who really could just use a bless your heart. This man has been through the ringer over the past year. And some of you may be wondering who that is, and that is the Brazilian leader, Bolsonaro. This man has just been through it all. He's contracted COVID, I believe, multiple times at this point, so bad where he's been in the hospital for both of his bouts. He has been mauled by emus that apparently just like frolic around the presidential palace or the presidential grounds in Brazil. And his latest thing has him back in the hospital because his intestines are so compacted that they are having to remove fecal matter through a hose in his nose. During one of his last sessions, they removed somewhere between 1 and 2 pounds of fecal matter through his nose. And at this point, this has to be a sign that he just needs to like retire and like just go live in a hospital rather than trying to run a country.
Does seem like karma in this aspect.
But we all know he's not going to give it up. He's even admitted he's going to run again, and if he loses the election, that he's just going to stage a military coup to stay in power. He's admitted this. So Bolsonaro, bless your heart. God is sending you a message to hang up your golden pen and enjoy what life you have left. Because if COVID won't get you, the emus won't get you, maybe your compacted intestines will get you. We don't know. So just get the medical treatment that you clearly desperately need. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Rob, thank you again so much for joining us. It was great to hear from somebody as knowledgeable as you are on this fight, especially something that's as close to home as it is here for us in Tennessee. Do you have an internet home or any pluggables?
Yes, absolutely. Our website is very simple, au.org. Go there. And from there, that's also a portal to our Facebook page, Twitter feed, Instagram, all that stuff that the kids like these days. You can get all that there. So check that out. And also, we publish a magazine every month that I edit called Church and State. You can look at issues there. And we also have a blog called The Wall of Separation. So you can get all that at au.org.
And Drew, what about you? Where do you live on the World Wide Web?
People can find me on Twitter at Andrew Dyson, and make sure to follow Change Tennessee Wire on there as well. That's at @ChangeTN_ on Twitter. Keep up with all the latest news and events and everything else that we're doing to try and change the state from red to blue.
Well, be sure to follow us on Twitter at @Pod_South. You can find me on Twitter at @Graham851. Also, make sure to leave us those sweet, sweet 5-star reviews as they help others discover us and hear the siren song of Appalachian leftists. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day.
Pod, pod of the South, not your daddy's Appalachian. Pod, pod of the South, progress can